Blog Talk Radio.
And it's that time again. Welcome to the K Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. My name is Eric Payne. I am the son. I am one of the co-hosts, and you are?
K Thompson, and I'm one of the hosts also. And welcome, everyone, to K Thompson Live. We have a lot to talk about, and I think you're going to really enjoy this because we're going to be talking about Broadway, on Broadway and off Broadway, how to get there and why. And we're going to be talking about the Chitlin Circuit. I have a few people call me and say, what is the Chitlin Circuit?
Make sure you get a little closer to the mic as we're talking.
We talked about, a couple of weeks ago, we had talked to Bernard J. Marsh, and his book is The Great White Way, Great White Lies, and he talks about a line that cannot live forever. And he talks about the difficulty that African-American actors and actresses, dancers and singers everywhere, had such a tough time getting to Broadway. And then we also talked about that the establishment of the Actors Equity Association, how they had treated him, and so he wants to let people know maybe, just maybe, there should be a possibility of a discussion, that's putting it lightly, I know, but, letting people know that, on Broadway, what is still not open for, African-American singers, and also Latinos. So we're going to be talking, and he's going to be pulling in about, about 20 minutes or so. And so we have a lot to talk to him about. Now, there's a lot going on politically. I know that. You want to start with that, Eric?
There's a lot going on. Just in the news in general, first let's talk about the big news last night. I think bigger than the politics was the tennis match with Venus and Serena. It was a very good match. Something historic, because obviously Serena beat Venus. Venus could have stopped her. Serena's march to the Grand Slam, or however that works. And it was really great to see the two sisters that love each other so much. They've been playing now for, 10, 11, 12? I forget how many years that they have been dominating the tennis circuit. And one thing about them, they're a very positive example for young women. To follow. We seem to want to perpetuate these negative images of how women are supposed to act, particularly young black women. You see a lot of really negative things to me, at least anyway. And the whole situation was why I'm saying that is because of the balance. And you never really see Serena, since Serena gets a lot of publicity, but the positive nature, the positive image that these women present. And when they could, go other ways and present other images of themselves. There's a popular image now about a lot of young women who want to show a lot of skin in their performances and want to have these characters shaking their butt, things like that. So it's really refreshing to see the Williams sisters, they're grown women now. I guess they're in their 30s, but still, they're young enough to affect and set an example for younger women of color and younger women, period, and how to act and how to be poised and the various things like that. So it's refreshing to see those two do their thing. If you are a tennis fan since way back, Ma got us all into tennis. Your thoughts on it?
Yeah, really, it's incredible because these two have been in tennis for a long period of time. I want to say years, of course years, but I want to pinpoint it. Because the fact that I was working over in New York at the WLDBOS radio station on the air, and when these two young ladies made an entree into tennis, that sort of blew up the whole tennis world. It was absolutely fantastic. This was after that, Arthur Ashe was leading by John McEnroe. And it was after that, and then the Tennis Center was starting to be built. And anyway, these two young ladies came into being with their beads in their hair. And they were taught by their father, you know, in California. I forget exactly where. It's on the tip of my tongue. You know, Compton. Was it Compton?
I don't know if they're from Compton.
Yeah.
They could be from Compton, but they're in California. But, Jen.
Yeah. And they were playing tennis. Everybody was so fascinated with that. And unfortunately, in the white world, you know, there was a whole lot of prejudice. And, you know, a lot of people didn't like the fact or couldn't get over the fact that they had a lot of beads in there. Well, we were all very tickled and very pleased, you know, that they were doing what they wanted to do and the fact that they were damn good. And when they started winning, it was absolutely amazing. And for years later, for them to be in their 30s, I think Venus is about 32 or 33, and I think Serena is about 3 years younger. And their mother was always with them. Their whole family was always with them. And it was just a very, very nice family situation. And, of course, it got to the point where every time they were playing, you know, we would be all on the air, and, of course, we would be talking about it. And it was absolutely great. And the other night when I went, I didn't see them play. I did see them play the next night because they played, you know, at the Open, which I was there. And I haven't been to the Open in a long time. And it's absolutely, absolutely fantastic. So those of you who are listening, if you ever get a chance to go, I think you should go, especially if you are tennis players or if you just enjoy tennis, which I do. I watch it practically every day that I can watch.
Yeah, U.S. Open is one of the premier events in New York City. Obviously, everybody knows it is a premier sports event. And you know, if you ever get a chance to go, anybody gets a chance to go, should go to the U.S. Open and check it out. It's something really fantastic now. And I'm going to open up the line. I see that our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, is with us. Wayne, welcome. How are you today, sir?
Hey, all right. Good evening. How's everyone there?
Good.
We're doing great. Thank you very much. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, you sound loud and clear. I hope I'm doing the same thing on your end.
Yes, absolutely. We're just talking about Venus and Serena, just wanted to know your thoughts about it, Wayne. I was going to say something, but I'm interested to hear what you thought. I don't even know if you're a tennis buff, but if, you know, you live in New York, so the U.S. Open is in New York, so...
Yeah, I tell you, I've been surrounded by tennis buffs in my life, my two sisters and close friends of mine. And to be honest with you, I did see one of the matches earlier in the week when the Open started with Serena. And phenomenal talent. I mean, from what I could see, and I'm sorry I missed the match last night with her sister, but I heard the results and, you know, class act. I mean, really, it was precedent setting and historical from all I've heard. And, you know, I guess when history looks back at these two young women, you know, they have certainly surpassed Althea Gibson and all the other heroes that have come out of our neighborhood, you know, doing that sort of athletic accomplishment. But, you know, it's just phenomenal to see the power and how and the resiliency of Serena. I mean, just when you think she's about to lose something, she can just turn on a dime and immediately come back with victorious results. So I think that's great.
Yeah. I mean, she is obviously she's the better of the two, but I wonder if Venus didn't have that autoimmune or whatever medical issue that caused her to get a little bit tired. You know, I wonder if that never was a factor. Really, how great the matches between them would be right about now. And
if her sister's any indication, I mean, Serena says that her sister is the fiercest competitor she's ever faced. You know. And you figure all the talent that she's faced in her lifetime in the sport, and she says her sister is that great, you can only assume that, you know, it's just unfortunate that she's been diagnosed with this illness. And I I guess there's very little that could be done about it.
Right, right. Another thing I wanted to say about those guys is what you touched on, Mom, when they first came on the scene. You know, they first came on the scene, they were a little less than polished as far as the tennis world was concerned. You know, their father would talk trash, and he would, you know, go through all these antics initially. And he would talk about his daughters were going to be great. They were going to be champions. And now, look, all these years later, not only were they champions one time, but they're champions over and over again, best of their generation. And to see how the tennis world initially tried so hard to reject them, tried so hard to not recognize their accomplishments, and their father had built them up so much when they were young and put that confidence in them at such a young age that nothing could shake their confidence. And you just have to give it up to that gentleman for creating these two very well-adjusted champion, not only in their acts and their athletic ability, but in their mentality. They carry themselves like champions. You know, they say a true champion is the way they carry, one who carries themselves like a champion. And Venus and Serena truly do that. And just their ethnicity, when they first came on the scene with the braids and their hair, coming from Compton or California, I'm not quite sure if they're from Compton, California, but their father refused to allow them for anyone to disrespect them or to interject and plant those seeds of self-doubt and things that adults can do to children and undermine children, some unknowingly, some knowingly. And I'm talking about an interview that I saw on the YouTube where a gentleman was, a TV reporter was interviewing Serena when she was a young girl. And he was asking her, she was like saying something like, I know I'm good, I know I can beat them. And the guy kept saying, well, how do you know? And she said, I know, I have confidence. And he kept questioning her. And her father said, listen, she already said that she knows she has confidence. Why do you keep questioning her on it? Why do you keep saying, how do you know? She already made her statement. Stop asking her. And he kind of stopped the interview. And the interviewer was a little bit frustrated, but you understood where her father was coming from, too, if you watched. And so maybe unknowingly this reporter was asking. Maybe he was just being genuine and just asking this question. But her father refused to allow this man to plant seeds of doubt within his daughter. And that's what I respect. And now all these years later, all those people have to bow down to Richard Williams for creating those two champions. Mom, you wanted to say?
Yeah. If not for Venus and Serena, that, you know, tennis, tennis players, you know, I get so filled up when I hear this because of the fact that that place was absolutely bad. Packed to the rafters every single night, especially when they play every single night. And then you think about the amount of money. But what I liked primarily and that the family structure is solid because of the fact that when you saw the match between Serena and Venus the other night, when they won and they hugged each other at the net and they, you know, sort of like consoled each other, and it was such a loving thing to see. You could see that they've been close. They've always been close year after year after year. And it was so pleasant to watch them see this family get together. The mother was always there. Richard, the father, was always there. He did some amusing things once that a number of times. But you know what I'm saying? The press, specifically the white press, gave them a fit. You know, and I could go on and on about the white press, and we're, you know, talking about them, including some well-known people in the press. And one of these days, I'm going to name names of the different people in the press who were, you know, very negative. And so what happened with the black community is we all rallied against them. I mean, not against them, but around them. Now, if you look, you know, I'm going to make a comparison with the feeling between these two young women. I don't know how many people saw The Color Purple. And it was a movie, but that was a glorious role that Whoopi Goldberg played. And what she was doing, her sister was taken away from her and sent to Africa by some people and whatnot. But anyway, when the sister came back, she was always waiting for the sister, years and years and years and years. And so when the sister came back, the love between those two sisters, you know, was just the same as Serena and Venus. So kudos to them. They're still there. Serena is still kicking you know what. So one of these days, I hope to get another interview with them. the first time I got to be, you know, interview with him was it was a reception. You probably remember this, the reception that I think David Dinkins, you know, was responsible for with them there, and they were being honored. So got to go to that, and that's when I first got to see them up close, and they were just gracious.
When was this that you got to interview
them? Oh, this was a long time ago, back to in the early part of when I first started at WLIB.
So it was what?
I guess that was the 1990s, or around that period, perhaps.
When they first came up.
Right.
Right, okay.
When they first came to New York, was that right,
right.
You know? Yeah.
Early in their career when they first were young women.
Yeah, because they were talking about it. Everybody was talking about it. These two little girls with these D's. And then when they came to New York, I mean, they were just a little bit older. I mean, they were older. But everybody, you know, just completely, you know, rallied around that. Sure, did they have the support of the Black community? Especially the young, they did. Because they're good, they're champions. Serena Williams is the champion of the world, everyone. The champion of the world. No one has beaten her. So it was really an enjoyable. I was glad to see the other night. So I love you guys. So Wayne, you want to be adding to this? You can, Dennis.
No. I just want to concur with Eric's sentiments about, you know, when it comes to having to defy the odds, you know, there's always that element that we have to pay a particular black tax. And this applies to everything. You know, as he was reciting, you know, what the father used to do to instill confidence, it reminded me some years ago, I don't want to call the person's name, but I had an opportunity to work for a predominantly liberal white network and that went across the country. And a comedian who suddenly turned senator would always remark to me, almost like in amazement, that when I read the news, it was like as if he had never seen someone of color before read news copy before. I don't know if it was the manner in which I would read a story or my interpretation of something, but I you know, the deal is that I think in one sense, I don't know if it was like his way of being somewhat sarcastic or comedic or what have you, but, you know, it got to a point where I know it was a backhanded compliment, but I can't help but feel, and I still to this day couldn't help but feel that the pathos or the source of this was a belief, a latent belief that, you know, we're only good enough to do but so much, and that's it. You know, I mean, our work or our role in anything should be just ancillary, and that we have to prove ourselves all the time. And, you know, it's despicable that in this day and age that we're still going through that, you know? And God forgive me, I could be wrong, but I just know how I felt in this particular circle, in that environment. And I think it applies to what goes on with Venus and Serena. Venus has so much class, you know, when you hear her speak and she does interviews. You know, I don't see much of the father or the mother anymore, almost to the point where I was asking a friend of mine the other day if the father was still alive. But there's such poise, such grace, such beautiful thought in her responses to the press. You know, and I'm not minimizing Serena, but Venus, it's a classy, classy woman, and I really respect that. And as you said, I was driving home from an event in Hackensack last night when this thing went down, and my cousin was telling me over the phone, you should see the two of them hugging. And I think that is so beautiful when, you know, two siblings could spar in one element and still each other and build each other up emotionally, you know. In that kind of setting, it must have been phenomenal.
Yeah, a lot of people can learn from them, you know, there's no doubt about it. There was an incident at a tennis club, I think the name of the club is, I don't even know, it's something Wells, Indian Wells comes to mind, I don't even know the name of that club, but it's something like that. And she was greatly insulted when she played there because they had not had black players. And I don't know where it is. I don't know if it's in California somewhere. Maybe somebody can call in or, you know, let us know. Let me know, Rusty. I'm just, you know, I cannot get that name of that in my head. It's just a good point, but I will. But anyway, what they did to Serena that day was horrible. You know, they called names. And I forgot whether or not she actually walked off the court or whatever. But anyway, I'm getting to this. She boycotted playing there. In other words, took her money and the money that comes in when she plays, which is in the millions, and said she would never play there again. Now, she played there, I think, within the last several months for the first time in, are you ready for this? 20 years.
Look at that.
And they lost money. They lost big bucks, okay? Because a lot of people just did not go, all right? Remember, there was a time that, you know, blacks could not even play on any tennis clubs. However.
And also, at this point, we're going to open up the phone line of our guest tonight, I believe. This might be our guest. Hello, caller. Your line is open.
Bernard Marsh.
Bernard Marsh. How are you today, Bernard Marsh?
I'm feeling quite wonderful.
Okay. Author of The Great White Way, Great White Lies, A Lie Can't Live Forever. And the other book would be? We know that you have written two books. What's the other one, Bernard?
The Night Has a Thousand Eyes.
The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. But
okay.
My mom just put it down, but what we're going to be concentrating on now is this book right here, The Great White Way, Great White Lies. Mom, you wanted to get into it.
Yeah, you know, Bernard, we've talked to you before, you know, and I wanted to review this book again because of the fact that, you know, you were talking about lies that can't live forever, and you were talking about Broadway, off-Broadway, and the fact that you have been in it, fighting the battle for a number of years, and you sound very angry, and from some things that you've written, I don't blame you. But you also sound like you are a fighter, and this is an absolutely fantastic book. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be including it in my Throwback Thursday book club, you know. So
wonderful.
Yeah, but I want to ask you, here's the other book you wrote, and this is The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, and this is Music is the Soundtrack of My Life, and that's an excellent also. But this one I want to talk about what was going on in Broadway? It was so racist that you couldn't get jobs or how? What happened? I know a whole lot about what happened, but I need you to tell us because of the position that you're in and still in at this time with the Actors Equity Association.
Well, it has always been limited. I mean, yeah. Access and the profitability and the means of making a living has always been limited. And it continues even to today. I mean, I just recently had a blog where the color girls have considered suicide after Rainbow Ends. They have approximately maybe 10 actresses in the show. And now that they went to Equity to ask them, could one of the actresses also be the assistant stage manager? Why would you? And of course, I know that the show is being produced by white producers. Why would you produce a show if you couldn't afford to hire an assistant manager? Why would you ask an actress to be an assistant stage manager as well as act on the stage and get paid for doing one job? They would only do this in a black production. They continuously have done that over the years, eliminating employment when there are a lot of stage managers, black stage managers, who are looking for work, either as a main stage manager or an assistant stage manager. So it is consistent. Look at the past Tony Awards. There was no black person nominated or even a representative, a presenter on stage.
Wow.
And this is 2015. This is now, for me, this is 25, 30 years that this same attitude persists. And it persists because
we do not have, or we have gone into their productions and waiting for their imprimatur to say that winning a Tony makes you a professional actor. Winning a Tony doesn't make you a professional actor. It just makes it that these people liked you. We had the Chitlin' Circuit. That was our imprimatur. If you were a star on the Chitlin' Circuit, you were a star. You got top billing. Even got your name above the title of whatever you were in. Even today, Audra McDonald has won. I think she's tied with, I don't even know who, I don't even pay attention anymore. But she has won more Tony Awards than most white actors, yet and still they have not written a show specifically to showcase her talent or even allow her name to appear above the marquee. So what's going on? It's continuous racism.
Yeah.
And it's racism applied by a group of people, mainly a group of people who know what racism is about, who mm-hmm. know what discrimination is.
Let me ask you a question. Now, you've mentioned the Chitlin' Circuit. Now, there are people out there that don't know what the Chitlin' Circuit is or was, you should say.
The Chitlin' Circuit was a circuit of theaters, nightclubs, around the country that only black performers were able to perform in. That's how they made their living. Dinah Washington, Cab Calloway, Louis Armstrong, that's where they made their money. It was a viable venue. But when desegregation came in, everybody went to the Copacabana. They went to the Flamingo, and they let these venues die. And to their own detriment, because only one or two could get in, whereas when you had the Chitlin' Circuit, if you weren't in a show in Chicago, you might have been a show in California, you might have been a show in Boston, you might have been in a show in New York. So you could make a living. You didn't have to depend on white people's approval of your work.
Mm.
They came to see you. They came uptown to the Cotton Club, to Connie's Inn, to find the talent and to steal what we had.
Mm.
The Gershwins were the greatest robbers of our music. But we just gave that to them. They came uptown to get it, and they took it downtown and put their own imprimatur on it and said, I created this. Paul Whiteman, the king of jazz, or whatever the hell he is, he stole our music. And then
yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry. I get excited about this.
I understand what you're saying. I don't disagree with you about that. We all know that, you know, it's the great white way, like we say. And you know the business that we're in, right, Bernard? Always call it. The business that we're in, the show business that we're in, I always call it the glorification of white people business.
Right.
You know, because whether you're doing plays or films or TV, there's a lot of times when what you're saying, you know, is true, that you're just there to serve the story for the lead character who's usually white. I know that Audra McDonald did a show. So what show did she did that Billie Holiday show?
At the Emerson Cafe.
That was last year.
Emerson Cafe.
Right. And that, but she is, you know, one of their favorites because she does always gets nominated, whatever she does. I think she got nominated for that award. I don't know if that was.
Right, she won a Tony.
Well, that was this year, right? This year's Tony. So, but you know,
last year.
It is hard, and it's like you said, almost every other year, you might have a couple of black plays that someone might squeak in there, but there is no, and I agree with you, there should be, like back in those days of the Chitlin' Circuit, whatever, plays for us, by us. And it's ironic that we're on the subject slightly of the Chitlin' Circuit, because that's what gave birth to Tyler Perry and individuals like that doing those type of plays, the Medeas and things like that. Now, the quality might not have been the best, but I first discovered how successful those plays like that were when I was doing a play down at Center Stage in Baltimore, Regional Theater. It was a play, and they had us on one of those, you know, how they give the black shows those different types of contracts. So when you go to Regional Theater and you do the theater, so we had, yeah, you get a Lord B or whatever, or there's some special thing or whatever. But so we were doing this one show, and there were no members of the black community were coming in because, as you know, and we probably talked about this the last time, when you perform at Regional Theater, those tickets are already sold, and they're based on subscribers a lot of the time. So what they'll do is once a year during Black History Month, they might bring in a black show, but they don't necessarily go out and advertise in the black community. So what happens is that when you have the black people in that show coming in, and you might go out in the community and you go to dinner and you go to a local black-owned restaurant, you tell them you're in a play, they're like, we've never even heard of it. But they sure heard about Madea and them across town because, you know what, Madea and them is advertising directly to the community, telling the people this is for you. And those shows have come out where they were making so much money, where a lot of TV actors were performing in them when their TV and film careers slowed down. They jump in these plays, and it turns out they're making sitcom money. You know, they're making thousands of dollars a week. And we're over here doing the equity show, working for the $1,500 or the $600 or the $800. They're over there making $2,500 a week. And nobody in the community even knows we're there. And this is what happened with a lot of August Wilson's work when you went across regionally across the country. I mean, a lot of people were aware of it because he was such a brilliant American playwright and had so much acclaim, so a lot of the white audiences would still come. But the people that needed to see August Wilson's work were the black people. And in these regional theater houses across the country, Cincinnati, Chicago, Chicago's a little bit different, but Cincinnati, Hartford, Connecticut, Pioneer Theater Company in out in Utah, where you might have five black people. But the black people in these communities that needed to see these shows would never be able to see these shows because they weren't made aware of that. So it's kind of like, you know, it's circular in the fact that we can't, like you're saying, unless we're producing our work and adding value to what we do, it kind of falls by the wayside or eventually dies, like the Motown show that I guess closed, you know, a couple months ago or whatever.
And it's
like you said, I mean, we really need to have our own, and that's what the modern day children's circuit is affording, and certainly now with technology being what it is in terms of TV and film, we can begin to make our own projects for us and by us and about us.
Well, the thing about it, too, is that people need to be educated not only in the art of performance, but in the art of the business of theater. Theater is a gamble. You may produce three plays. You may produce four plays, but maybe only one of them hits. That's the one you go for. But with today, with the many million black millionaires and billionaires that we supposedly have in this country, they afford, all they want to do is get in and make that one-hit wonder. They don't know how to invest. They don't know what it is to invest in theater and what the focus of theater is. Theater is a learning process. It has always been a learning process, way back to the Greeks. White people understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see it. We see it as, if I don't make no money off it, I don't want to be bothered with it. No, but that is your investment. That is another way to invest in your community. That's another way to invest in your history, because your history is constantly being told. And when it becomes one spectacular thing, it's like raising in the sun. They told Lorraine Hansberry, yes, she did a wonderful job, but they only gave her credit for the writing. They never really went into the psychological element of what she was trying to say to black people, and black people missed the boat. Only until about a year ago, I saw this in a very amateur play. On theater, and I went to dinner with a couple of people, and the person said, I really, you know, it's the first time I realized what she was saying. I said, yeah, she was talking about Africanism, blackism. That's not what they told you when they in the 50s when her play came out. They just tell you how elegantly she expressed the black experience. But they never went into the depths of what she was telling you. Black folks, wake up.
Yeah.
Wake up. You know,
yeah.
That's what we need to have in our theaters. That's what we need to make our theaters. We can't keep waiting for the fat lady to sing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
No. We have to know why she sang. Why is she singing that note?
Yeah.
But when you go to the Jewish... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah. You were or are the founder and chairman of the Performance Against Racism on the theatrical stage, Heart.
Right.
You're also an author, dancer, singer, choreographer, and director. You're a member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, better known as ASTRA, which a number of us belong to, and rightly so. Food Actors Guild and the Equity Association, and you have a lot to do with the committees and what's going on. So tell us about what's going on at Broadway. What can you do about it? And I want to know about the Black Theaters Network newsletter information so that people can actually find out what is going on, on Broadway.
My suggestion has always been that we need to get out of those guilds because those guilds are run by white folks.
Mm.
And white folks are only going to take care of their own. Your problems are not their problems. They'll satisfy your problem with telling some producer, well, you need to put somebody black in here. I don't give a damn who he is or what she does. But just put somebody black here so we can, you know, satisfy the black constituency. But they do not take care of your problem. Your consistency of work is what you want. And as long as you keep giving our money to these unions, especially Actors Equity, which is the greatest, to me, offender of this continuousness of racism. Because the people who make the decisions to rectify your problems are the council, which is made not up of 99% white folks who have no idea of the cultural matters that black people face. They come from all manners of walks of life, all around the country, with all of their preconceptions of what black people should have and shouldn't have. And that is how they decide their decisions when you come to them and say, I have a problem in being hired. I have a problem in auditioning. Here it is. I brought to them five cases of outright discrimination. And till today, they are still having the people are coming back with the same problem. I can't be seen. They're supposed to have diversity in casting. What diversity do you see in casting on Broadway? What diversity do you see today in casting? They're still casting white people in white roles, and if they find some maid or some character who's a maid, they might make that person a black person. But they will not make him a star. Except for you can't take it with you because they needed James Earl Jones and they needed whoever that producer was needed to make himself some money, so they put him in there to show his popularity. But other than that, he goes back to the woodshed. After that, who knows? They don't give him a Tony, they don't give him an Oscar. You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What about numbers? If you were to give a percentage about the numbers of black actors on Broadway, if you were to give a percentage of numbers of people working on Broadway, maybe even off Broadway, but maybe on Broadway, how would you respond to that?
It's a minimal amount. There's a minimal amount of us working. if you're not Audra McDonald or Brian Stokes Mitchell, who cares? Even Lilias White, who won a Tony for the Life, she's still struggling. She's still living uptown in Harlem, trying to make a living, going to nightclub.
Oh, yeah, you're not going to make a living doing plays.
but I'm saying, and probably she has a white manager who can't do no more for her than what I could do, because I could go to the supper club in Booker. You know,
ooh,
I can go to the Shark Bar in Booker.
Uh-huh.
You know, but is she being booked in Las Vegas? Is she being booked in Hollywood?
Mm-hmm.
No, she's getting local bookings.
Right.
I could walk around with my suitcase in my hand and in my demo and say, can I come in here and sing for you? And you pay me a couple of dollars? But I still keep my day job. In the fact that I'm retired and I got a pension, that's what I would have to do.
Wow.
Right.
They don't allow us to make the kind of money that you can sit back and relax and enjoy your life. You have to constantly work. And I know Lilias is damn near 60 or 65, ready to get her Social Security, and she still has to work.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, and I'm sure you've noticed this too, Bernard, what always trips me out is about how they keep recycling these old plays, these old... Well,
but they won't revive a black play. Have you heard any of them?
Not only will they won't revive a black play, they won't even have a new one. You know,
because why should they invest in you?
Exactly.
When they got Carousel, they can do Carousel 30 times a year.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, do you think they would do Bubbly Brown Sugar? Do you think the Amos Behaving will ever be revived? Which were landmarks. Even The Wiz, which stayed on Broadway for 5 or 6 years, you think they would revise that? No, they took The Wiz and made an abomination of it with this NBC production, this television production, of having Harvey Fierstein rewrite the script for Harvey Fierstein. What cultural awareness, what black cultural awareness does he have? Why would you need him to rewrite The Wiz? And then he brings in Latifah to play The Wiz. You mean to tell me you couldn't find... I saw Andre DeShields at the National Theater Conference in Winston-Salem, South Carolina, and I saw him at the anniversary of The Wiz, the 40th anniversary of The Wiz, on Summer Stage in Central Park. This man could still do The Wiz. Why didn't you hire him?
You know what that's about. Andre DeShields is not selling no tickets because nobody remembers who he is.
No.
All the Hollywood names, are the ones that they seem to want to always highlight. You know, which is tired after a minute.
But fine. But it's only going to be seen once. NBC is only going to see it once.
Right.
The Wiz
is
of such popularity that anyone, if they market it to the black audience would eagerly sit up and watch it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and if NBC is going to invest, if they took the time to invest in The Wiz, then they have the money to. Or are they saying, well, instead of putting $300 million in it, we could do it for $100 million and reap $5 billion in residuals.
Right, right.
You know,
that's how they do.
And it's an abomination. You've taken a landmark historical black play and now you've allowed some white writer to step in, rewrite it. Do his transgenderism, and I'm all for LGBT, but if it ain't about affecting me, I don't give a damn about it.
Mm.
So his LBG transgender with The Wiz itself, having Latifah in it, means nothing to me. Right. It means nothing to black people.
Right.
Why would you make this male character into a woman?
Probably because they thought that was new and a fresh idea.
That's what they thought Harvey Firestein was going to bring.
Right.
And why do I need Harvey Firestein to tell me about being black?
Right.
The Wiz is not the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, one of them probably owns the rights to it, though. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was not an African American.
I'm just saying, we've allowed these abominations to continue. We don't say anything. All we do is complain about it.
Right.
What about the black actors and actresses who are somewhat successful today? I mean, do you feel that they have the fire and the inner desire to make a change? You know, the very things that you're talking about is stuff I am certain that they've experienced and historically have known about the setbacks that we've gone through as a people. You know, do you think that they're not collectively doing enough to bring about a meaningful change in the direction this industry is going?
Well, in that category, there has to be a collectiveness of, you know, there's a collective effort. And in a collective, there can only be one president. There can't be three presidents.
Oh.
Egos get in the way because they will turn around and say, well, I make X amount of it, so I should be the president, or I should be the president. Instead of saying, no, this is not about being the president. This is about getting ourselves started. This is about creating the atmosphere of independent investment. It's like
right. You
people praise Tyler Perry, wonderful, wonderful, but where is he bringing the other producers in? Where is he creating other producers that can do the same work? That can do that, that can get the money as a collective. It's like Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, when they got tired of the industry running them, they created their own production companies.
Mm-hmm.
Why haven't Jay-Z and Beyonce and P. Diddy formed an organization that collectively puts their money together to produce something that is beneficial for the black race and encourage us to say, now here's where we can work, here's where we can demonstrate our artistry? No,
yep.
Because they want to be, no, I can't share this position with Jay-Z.
Unfortunately, that is the age-old question of our people. Bernard Marshall, I want to thank you for being on the show, for talking to us about what goes on Broadway and the repeating problem that seems to be the situation that we as African-Americans and other people of color face in trying to get recognition and have our stories told. We thank you for writing this brilliant book, Great White Way, Great White Lies, A Lie Can't Live Forever, and, of course, your other book, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. I want to thank you once again for joining us, and we're going to have you back again to get in a little bit more depth about your other book.
Well, thank you for letting me expound and get this off my chest. I appreciate it.
you serve the association and the union well.
Thank you.
In the driver's seat. Right, Wayne?
Okay. I agree. I mean, he said a lot right there.
God bless you.
Thanks, Bernard. We'll have you back. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That was certainly eye-opening, as it always is, to get Bernard's insight.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's someone who's a veteran of this business.
Right.
And he's got just maybe two or three more years, Bernard, if you're still on the line, than me. But it certainly is, you know, we need to have people that are willing to fight the fight, you know, for our people on every endeavor. And, you know, as an actor, one who knows, you know, a lot of times the actors don't want to make waves because they always think that I'm going to be the one, I'm going to get in there, like you said it, like he was just saying about some of those people who have achieved a certain level of financial success, financial independence, and artistic success.
that sometimes we don't build a foundation for our people, and we appreciate him enlightening us to that.
I happen to agree, Eric. I mean, I don't know that end of the business that well, but as he was talking, I'm reminded of the young lady, I couldn't think of her name until just now, Marla Gibbs. Had it not been for her starting a school and a production company in Los Angeles, my cousin, who has been relatively successful in film, you know, she got to start with her. The young lady who played Ray Charles's wives, I can't think of her name. You know, the deal is that you get to a certain height in this business and you got to give back, and we have a tendency not to give back.
Yeah, it's that crabs in the barrel. It's also just that struggle to get to the top. Sometimes we don't realize that we need to do it collectively.
Yeah.
And, you know, Marla Gibbs was, I mean, her theater was, when I got to L.A. and did my time out there working and stuff like that, her theater company was known. It was one of those places that was known that she started a theater company away in the community, away for African-American performers to get their chops and to learn the business. And as you said, your cousin started there. A lot of people came out of her theater company. And she did this, I believe, at part of the height of her fame when she had 227 going.
Exactly.
And I think she started it around then. And when it went for her, it was most convenient. So, you know, it's definitely something that's necessary, that we need to have those individuals that will lay that foundation, but they also have to be aware that it has to be, a foundation that everybody can build upon. And I think that you see that out of some of these individuals. Oprah's producing a lot of things, Tyler Perry. And as the industry changes and technology changes, things will become easier for people to make their own products. So that's kind of the great leveler. I think it's going to be leveling the playing field a lot. Before we jump off, let's talk about a little bit of politics. I don't know, the Donald Trump mess. The one thing maybe you guys want to comment on it the other day, where the lady got out of jail, the woman who decided that she was going to tell people who could be married and who couldn't be married, and to object against the Supreme Court decision. And it's just ironic that, people don't understand this, the separation of church and state. A lot of these people who talk this stuff, they always cite the Constitution, but then they don't want to live by the Constitution. It's always kind of funny to me. It's real clear that separation of church and state is in the Constitution, but these people always, when it comes to their issues, they want to change the Constitution. And you even have these, and you even have these presidential candidates like Huckabee and Cruz, who want to talk about, and now Huckabee is all against the Supreme Court. Those guys shouldn't be allowed to determine for everybody what's going on. But and then the next time, of course, Huckabee is going to be for the Supreme Court when they're talking about Citizens United and other crazy kind of things. It's really interesting how they kind of play both sides against the middle. And people are talking about this woman was in jail, or some people even tried to compare to Martin Luther King, which is, you know, they always want to denigrate the things that are sacred to us. And there's no comparison between this woman and Martin Luther King. You want the same
She was going against the Supreme Court of the United States, and I'm surprised that she got the press that she did. And I'm surprised that people let her even get that far. And people, that is really a doozy out there. And her, that she's going, you better believe it. She's breaking the law. Anyway.
Well, they already have, you know, their own constitution. There is the constitution, decided upon our forefathers that everyone knows is institutionalized with respect to the United States government. And then they have their own separate interpretation. And the thing is that they feel that they can bring about a change or turn the clock back to how things were if they could find a constituency to do it. I tell you, it's at a point now, this whole campaign season has been a circus, you know, starting with Donald Trump on down. I waiting for the day that Ben Carson comes along, somehow completely, that he could just get off the world stage and go back to doing whatever it is he thinks he's doing, and that's it. But I'm concerned about the Democrats now. I'm really concerned about, you know, people like Hillary and I haven't heard anything lately about Biden. You know, perhaps he's still on the fence. But, you know, where the world is in turmoil. Our economy is not as confident as it could be. And, of course, the Republicans will immediately point at Obama. I'm looking at the strife that's going on in Syria, you know. It blows me away. 4 million people, you know, just leaving the country in droves, you know.
Right.
We got to get serious about what's happening here.
I'd like to hear you comment on de Blasio, you know, and Kelly.
De Blasio is in a very interesting position. There are a lot of people out here who would just rather have him as a one-term mayor. And you have Giuliani who's fighting, trying to stir the pot with that periodically. I am amazed at the relationship between de Blasio and Cuomo. You know, there are times when you would think de Blasio doesn't even exist, you know, in the governor's eyesight. And I just wonder how much of this political infighting is going to hurt the party, even on a national level, you know?
Mm-hmm.
De Blasio has his issues with Hillary with respect to some things that went on going back to when he was running her campaign, you know, 7-8 years ago. But the thing is now, there's got to be some healing within the party in order for it to move forward, you know? There's a lot at stake, and I speak, you know, as a proud Democrat, and I just hope that there's a coming together on some level.
Yeah, and hopefully it will come together. It seems kind of odd that de Blasio and Cuomo seem to sometimes not be on the same page, but we're coming up just about at the end of the show. And Wayne, you said it perfectly there. That puts the button in the end of this show. We want to thank everybody for listening to us, those that have tuned in to listen to us today. This has been the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can listen to us every Wednesday evening live from 8 to 9 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio / Kay Thompson Live. Or you can listen to any one of our shows that have been archived. We'd like to say once again, thanks again to Bernard J. Marsh for being our guest again tonight. I see you, Ma. Don't worry. I'm going to let you sign off. And Wayne Gilman, thanks once again for being the co-host.
Thank you.
Thanks to Gina. I'm reviewing it for you. Drawing attention to that video that was produced probably by Andy Tavern.
There's a video that this school system put on my mom. And I wonder what she's talking about. Go to her Facebook page. You can see it. It's a little quick biographical video about her. All right. Thanks for listening.
Oh.
We'll see you again next week. Wayne, go to her page, Kay Thompson Facebook page. Everybody, thanks again for calling in. We'll see you again next week.
Peace. I'm going to go to the next one.